It's Friday, March the 24th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. It's our wrap of the week. I'm Hugh Linehan. I'm joined by Pat Leahy and Jack Horgan-Jones to review proceedings. Pat, we were talking about Scotland on Wednesday, but this was a pretty significant week on the domestic political front as well. You're in Brussels, but it's been a busy enough week in Dáil Éireann.
Yeah, it has. I mean, it revolved around that vote on the ending of the eviction ban on the Sinn Féin motion. The motion was discussed on Tuesday. The vote was taken on Wednesday. This has been a very difficult period, I think, and actually, I think, damaging period for the government since the announcement that the eviction ban would end on at the end of this month. So it ends, I think, this day week or maybe tomorrow week. But I think the government is kind of stumbling into something that it is a little bit unaware of the dimensions of it when it comes to the politics of it. I think if the opposition have called a tsunami of evictions takes place, however likely or unlikely that is, but if you at least get a big uptick in the number of people being issued with notices to quit, and of course a notice to quit isn't the same thing as an actual eviction. The Taoiseach has been making that point here in Brussels this morning. But I still think the politics of all this, from the government's point of view, stinks. And the longer the opposition can keep it going, they will. And so we will have more votes on it next week. There's a motion of no confidence put down by Labour. There's a rather cleverer, I think, device put down by Sinn Féin, which is to table actual legislation so that the people who were able to, the independent TDs, I suppose, who were able to almost sort of hide behind the government's counter motion this week, won't be able to do that next week and will have to vote specifically against a legislative measure which would extend the eviction ban. So I think it's all been very difficult for the government, notwithstanding the fact that they survived the motion and they will survive the motions next week. Apologies, there's some French people walking past making a bit of a racket as they go for their lunch. But I think it's a very difficult period for the government, and that will continue next week.
We'll leave Pat to his French people there for a moment, Jack. But it does seem to be the case, doesn't it, that certainly this week and probably next week as well, There's little fear of the government running into, you know, serious problems with the motion of no confidence, for example. They seem to be solid enough with the support of various independents. They won the votes fairly comfortably this week. And so even if they're under a little bit more pressure, as Pat suggested, next week, they're pretty grand.
Yes and no, really. So the margin was fairly healthy this week. All right, 15 votes. But I think that belies a deeper issue, which is that the shape, that is the composition and the size of the government majority in the Dáil, particularly on housing issues, is now a live matter that has to be considered. And their ongoing capacity to comfortably win these things can't be taken as a given. And that while the Sinn Féin motion and the government counter motion this week, they fairly took in their stride, and they'll probably take the motion of no confidence next week and the vote on the Sinn Féin legislation next week also in their stride, I think that this is the beginning of what we should expect to see, which is a series of sally forths from the opposition probing the strength of that majority at any given time and at any opportunity. It also suggests that I think the most significant part of this week, and I'm sure we'll get onto this in more substantive detail, is the principle that the coalition seems to have accepted, even if Leo Varadkar was saying that there was no formal agreement with the regional independent group, but the principle that they've accepted is that some form of policy setting power or some form of concessions on policy can be made by the government to that group of floating independents upon whose support they may increasingly be reliant. That, I think, is a significant development. It's almost like a kind of shadow version of confidence and supply, because their on-paper majority is so thin at the moment, down to just one TD. So I think that's a really interesting and really kind of crucial development. And I think that more intangibly, and I'd withhold kind of final judgment on this until we see a kind of good series of polls that have been taken after the decision to lift the eviction ban. But more intangibly, there's a kind of vibe shift underway. After the budget, the government really felt it was hitting its straps. You know, I mean, how could it not? It spent 11 or 12 billion or something like that. And notwithstanding a kind of bumpy start to Leo Varadkar's return to the Taoiseach's office, there was no reflection really, aside from a little dip for Fianna Fáil. There's no reflection that was having an impact in the polls. And, you know, the most importantly, I think Sinn Féin had kind of continued this plateau. If this vibe shift manifests itself as a polling knock, I think they'll really take that to heart. I was talking to one person this week who said that they hadn't seen the offices of the leaders this rattled in the term of the government. And I think that could be really significant. When you look at leadership level, if they're getting rattled, then they're perceiving a weakness. Now, that's just one person's view, so we shouldn't put too much weight in it, but, you know, we shouldn't entirely discount it either. There's also the backbenchers aspect. You talked to backbenchers in and around Leinster House this week, and of course they were fairly bullish because it was clear they were going to win this, but they don't like being put in these kind of positions. They don't like negative news cycles. They don't like things coming into their constituency clinics, and they don't like every time they go out on local or national media having to defend unpopular policies. And it looks like they're just going to have to do that time and again on housing issues. So I think that there is a really important potentially hinge in the kind of the lifespan of this government underway. And I think that, you know, we often talk about when we're discussing the kind of political controversy of the day, is this something that we're going to be talking about at the end of the year? And that's kind of a rough litmus test that we have as political reporters. I think this is not only something we'll be discussing at the end of the year, I suspect it'll be something that we are going to be discussing at the end of this government's life cycle and during the election.
This vibe shift, Pat, obviously it derives from the eviction ban decision. Obviously, the consensus, the majority view within the government parties was that they couldn't avoid making this decision at this time. Do you agree with that? And is there any way that they could have approached it in a different way that they wouldn't have dug quite as big a hole as they seem to have for themselves?
Well, yes. I mean, Jack's responsibility on the political team is to be the interpreter of vibes. But occasionally I chip in on vibe evaluation myself. So in answer to your question, I think we'll probably have to wait a few weeks to see how this plays out. But my guess is that this does mark a change of vibe, as you describe it, for the government, because I think what is going to happen is that there will be some evictions. There will be difficult personal stories of people who are issued with notices to quit, who have nowhere to go. And it only takes a couple of those stories to be brought out in the media to focus political attention on it. And I think as a result of lifting the eviction ban, I think that culpability for this will increasingly be zeroed in on the government, you know, no matter what happens. And in the normal course of events in a property market, notices to quit are issued all the time. Some people are some people are evicted. But when that happens at all now, I think fingers are going to be pointed at the government on it as a result of the controversy. Was there another way of going about it? Yes. And this is the thing that has surprised me about the government's sort of just political preparations for this. We all thought that the ban was going to be extended, but for a short period of time and with some mitigations to be put in place. So we thought it might go until the start of the summer. And in the interim period, all the bits and pieces that the government has been scrambling to put in place would be prepared so that the government could then say, you know, we're lifting the ban in, you know, 2 months' time or 3 months' time. During that 3 months, we will have prepared these mitigating circumstances so as to ensure that people are not evicted into homelessness insofar as that is possible. But that hasn't happened. And that has been the thing that surprised me on it. I think, you know, there's a broader question of the government's handling of the housing crisis, of course, but there's also the short-term question of this particular issue. And to be honest, I think they've made a hames of it.
So the Green Party lost Nasa Horrigan, not for the first time in the term of this government, Jack. How much of a problem is this for the Green Party in particular?
Well, I think it's a problem for the government writ large, and I'll dwell on that for 1 minute before moving on to the Greens. I think that Pat is right. Like, they mishandled the execution of what they themselves say was an unavoidable policy decision by not preparing themselves well enough, by not having this, you know, series of mitigating measures oven ready. And that has compounded a decision that was always going to be painted by the opposition as being more in the interests of landlords than those of tenants. And I think that in turn is made worse by, you know, interventions like that which the Taoiseach made this morning. Pat was at a doorstep with him over in Brussels, and he was articulating the difference between, you know, a notice to quit and an eviction. And, you know, while he is right in point of fact, I think that, you know, this makes the government look like it has a tin ear for the very real difficulties that people are going through. And it makes it look like they can't understand that, you know, a notice to quit in and of itself, even if it doesn't arise in an eviction order given by the courts, is a really difficult thing for a household to go through, and that there is a large group of people out there who are getting these things. And even if you're not getting one, you know, you're in a fairly tenuous form of tenure, and that is a large and growing group of the electorate. And so they've kind of mishandled this, both in terms of how they've, you know, presented themselves and in terms of, you know, doing the politics, getting ready for it. And I think that if you look at how the Green Party have handled it, that's a good example of the politics not being prepared, because they weren't able to square away all their backbenchers, losing one and an open question playing out over the last week or 10 days over another. There's other examples of them not doing the politics well enough, not getting the preparations in place. The most obvious one being the fact they had to make a bunch of concessions to the regional independent group, but also the fact that this reform around nursing homes, allowing nursing home residents to keep 100% of their income, wasn't adequately politically proofed within the coalition itself, as evidenced by the fact that Mary Butler, the Minister for Older People, told the Irish Times on Wednesday that she hadn't been consulted on this. She wasn't happy with it. And that she, I think today, on Friday, is meeting with Dara O'Brien, the Minister for Housing, to hash this out and to thrash it out to a certain extent. So, you know, again, there's this sense that, you know, they haven't prepared well enough. When you get into the Greens, I think the Greens are in a really tricky spot at the moment. We had last week's difficulties around their head of communications issuing a bad tweet about Nasa Hourigan before she was going out on broadcast, and then the leaked WhatsApp messages, you know, with people raising this, WhatsApp channels being locked and so on and so forth. And there was more of that over the weekend. And like, why that matters is not so much what is being leaked, it's the fact that it's being leaked. It's the fact that, like, there is clearly unhappiness within the party more largely, and that this issue around housing and how Nasa Hourigan has been punished for voting against the government has reopened this old rift within the Green Party. And now you see Green Party councillors going out and being actively critical of the leadership and of the decision to remove the whip from Nasa Hourigan for 15 months and to take all her Oireachtas committee privileges off her, because she's seen as being a particularly effective and diligent contributor to Oireachtas committees. I mean, I was talking to one councillor this morning who privately said, a Green councillor privately said, there needs to be a discussion on leadership and the future direction of the party. And I mean, that's a significant development, because while Eamon Ryan, as we've said before, is comfortable in the position that he is within the parliamentary party, you know, the broader Green Party, I think, is not as happy a church as they might like to present. And the last week or so, the last couple of weeks, has been evidence of that. And I think they have a broader problem as well. So if you look at, and I've been doing this over the last day or so, if you look at the polling performance currently of the Green Party and compare it against the polling performance that they had, as according to the Irish Times Ipsos MRBI exit poll in 2020, I think they have the beginnings of a little bit of a problem. If you look at how they did then and where they did well then and where they're polling well now, or how they're polling in those key demographics now. So if you look at, for example, right, if you look at Dublin, usually a hotbed of kind of, you know, liberal progressive intent and somewhere where the Green Party does relatively well. In 2020, the exit poll suggested that they got 12.9% of the vote in Dublin. They're currently polling at 8%, so a fairly substantial decrease there. If you look at the 18 to 24-year-old category, this is nationwide, the Green Party, according to the exit poll, got 14.4% of the vote, currently polling at 8% of the vote. And then if you look at that other, the second youngest age category, that of 25 to 34, the Green Party got 9.1% of the vote, and a 25 to 34 current polling, according to February's Irish Times poll, 5%. So I think that, as I say, they may have the beginnings of a bit of a problem there. And Eamon Ryan was saying at the time of the Green Party conference last year that he expects that 10% of the electorate will vote Green. Now, whether that means voting for a party with Green tendencies or voting for the Green Party itself, he didn't quite precisely describe. But like, I think they have an issue here. And I think that, you know, they have an issue with making it clear that their main purpose in government, which is to, you know, achieve green reforms and environmental successes, if that's not landing with those key demographics that were very important to the coalition that saw them have a good result in 2020, and it's coming against the backdrop of discord within the party and you know, the issues with NASA Horgan, I think they have an issue here that they have to address.
So internal divisions, external pressure ramping up in Dáil votes, and a heightened public perception of incompetence. That's not a good look, is it, overall, Pat?
No, Hugh. It most certainly is. It most certainly is not. I see you draw on all your years of political analysis experience to make that telling point. Yeah, of course. You know, and but I, you know, in a way, I think, you know, what we have to try and do is kind of figure out, as Jack says, you know, is this still something we're talking about at the end of the year? Does this mark a turning? Does this mark a turning point? I think there's a very real possibility that it does. Governments sometimes reach a stage that people just, sorry, babbling Italians walking past at present, but governments sometimes reach a stage that that people almost switch off from them, and it doesn't matter what they do after that, because no matter what they say after that, people just aren't listening to them. Now, I don't think that this government is at that point yet, but maybe for some of those younger voters who Jack cites in those numbers a couple of minutes ago there, maybe because of the housing issue, they are beginning to switch off from the government. And, you know, if it becomes hard for the government to talk to, you know, people under 40 or people under 40 who don't own a property, that's a heck of a chunk of the electorate to become unavailable for you. And you know, I think that there are obvious dangers, electoral dangers for the government in that. Again, that's not to say this government is now over. It's not. But it seems to me that they're in a very perilous position right now, which we wouldn't have said, I think, at the start of this year or in the second half of last year.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Just before we do that, let me remind you, if you have not done so already, of the merits of taking out a subscription to IrishTimes.com, Ireland's foremost newspaper, where you'll get coverage of both Irish and international affairs. We'll take a break. We'll be back after this. And welcome back. Pat, staying with you in Brussels, because the agreement, the Windsor Framework Agreement, putting an end to division over the Northern Ireland Protocol between the EU and the UK, I gather was signed or has been agreed officially. I take it all of Brussels is en fête as a result.
You wouldn't believe the excitement here, Hugh. No, actually, nobody here has paid any attention to it whatsoever. Now, there is a line in the agreed conclusions of the summit that welcomes this development, and certainly I think it was the case that people in Brussels were looking at that vote in the House of Commons during the week to see what sort of a majority that Rishi Sunak could muster in favour of it. Now, as it turned out, it was a whopping majority. There was a bit of a rebellion on the Conservative benches, but I think there's very much a sense in London and perceived here that, you know, this is essentially put to bed now. As a
former prime minister has voted against it, I note.
Indeed, and some other loons in the Tory party. It's a good way of identifying them, I think. You know, but when prime ministers of the stature of Boris Johnson and Liz Truss are standing against you, I think you can take that as a reasonably good sign. But I think there is obviously an ongoing issue for the British government and the Irish government with the rejection this week by Geoffrey Donaldson of the Windsor Declaration, voting against it in the House of Commons, announcing that they wouldn't, though he didn't say ever Nor did he say, not now, go back into the Stormont institutions. So there is an expectation, I think, in both in London and in Dublin, that Donaldson is playing something of a long game and that the institutions will not be suspended indefinitely. As to what the plan is, if they are suspended indefinitely, and nobody has any firm indications insofar as we know as to what sort of timescale Jeffrey Donaldson is acting on, doesn't seem to me there's any sort of a plan any sort of a plan B there. But certainly, as far as Brussels goes, this episode is now more or less closed.
Newton Emerson, in our opinion pages this week, Jack, suggested basically that Donaldson's plan anyway is to make it through the May local elections in Northern Ireland and then somewhat sourly troop back in to Stormont at some point in the weeks or months after that. That seems pretty plausible, although there probably is still a question about whether he can avoid a really serious split or a division in his own party to achieve it. But it doesn't seem unlikely. And in fact, it's not unlike the pattern of the way the DUP has reconciled itself to some things in the past.
I think that's true. I mean, they have a history of strong critiques, very vocal critiques, and then kind of getting on with it. And I suspect that may be where we end up here. And I would share the endorsement of our colleague Newton Emerson's column. I think it was in yesterday's Irish Times on Thursday, and people should go and read it. I think that they will be given enough runway for that as well, I suspect. There was a little bit more impatience I picked up following the Westminster vote this week. I just noted that the Taoiseach said it was disappointing, which is the most kind of incremental ratcheting up of the rhetoric around the DUP from the Irish government, but not a systemic fundamental departure from their overall approach, which is to give them time and space to see the light. And I think that ultimately, you're right. I think they are likely to come back in after the local elections. Because they're looking over their shoulder, aren't they, at the traditional unionist voice, and they can't risk being seen to be soft on the issue just before an electoral outing. But will we see the Stormont institutions sitting again before the end of the year? I suspect we might. What do you think, Hugh?
I think he will definitely try to go for it, and I think probably the majority of the party will go with him. But he might lose. And it's interesting that the hardest wing of his party, in terms of electoral representatives, are the people in Westminster, rather than necessarily the people in the Assembly. And maybe that's because, isn't what they say is, a man will do anything if his salary depends upon it. So maybe it's something to do with that.
I agree entirely.
I think there's also pretty clear polling in the North that suggests that people want the Assembly back up and running. They want, they see there's been changes made to the protocol, and there is a demand amongst people across all communities in the North to get their political representatives back in working for them. And I think ultimately that exerts its own pressure on Donaldson as well. I mean, the thing that I heard, and this was discussed an awful lot, I was in Washington last week and in New York for St. Patrick's Day events, and it was very Northern focused for the entire period across the two cities. Jeffrey Donaldson and other unionists were there as well, of course, and apologies, it's goose-stepping Prussians at this stage. But the question that was asked on several occasions, in conversations on this, is what is his alternative? What does he do if he, if he doesn't go back in? And, nobody seemed to be able to figure that one out.
Seems to me that if we keep this podcast going long enough, we can get every European stereotype under the sun going past behind you. So
I'm working on that. I'm working on that, Hugh.
Let's keep going with it. Can I ask you, just in terms of what you're doing there, Pat, and you said you doorstepped Leo Varadkar and he made his comments about evictions. In your close observation of the man, he seems to be getting more loose-lipped than ever, or speaking his mind, or, speaking thoughts out loud that perhaps should be kept to himself. Is that unfair? But it just seems to be happening an awful lot at the moment.
Well, personally, Hugh, this is a trend that I'm very much in favour of, if it is as you describe it. He made some pretty frank comments this morning about the nature of evictions, pointing out that people aren't evicted by notices to quit. They only be evicted by court orders. And he was made a bit of a gaffe, I suppose, last week in Washington, where he made a sort of a, you know, depending on your view, either clumsy or, you know, quite good joke about interns in Washington during the Clinton administration, which he subsequently very quickly apologized for. But so, you know, maybe is he becoming a little more loose-lipped than usual? Well, I mean, if you remember Mr. Varadkar's rise to prominence and rise to the leadership of his party and the office of Taoiseach was accompanied by his widespread sense that he, you know, he kind of shoots from the hip. It's Spaniards on the way to the siesta. But it was very much based on a sense that, you know, he wasn't really like, you know, careful like other politicians. He, you know, he says it as it was, and, you know, he spoke his mind, and that was always seen as very much a political plus for Leo Varadkar in the period of his ascent towards high office. I suppose, though, when you get there, speaking your mind and speaking frankly, you know, can have its own, perils, but as I say,
there is a sense with some political leaders, isn't it? I mean, you've seen it with, I'm not making this direct comparison, but you've seen it with Donald Trump and with...
We're about to be joined on the podcast by the Minister for Public Expenditure, who is the latest group to walk past. Would you like to say hello to our podcast, Minister?
I'd never want to interfere with a live broadcast.
He's moving on.
All right, there's an opportunity for your Irish cultural stereotype now.
He's probably going for a few pints. Yeah. He's making drinking gestures at me. No, he's not.
But, he's probably gone, so you probably can't ask him this. I'd be interested to know his view on this. You know the way that they say, let Trump be Trump and let Boris be Boris? Is there a little bit of let Leo be Leo here?
I thought you were going to say let Pascal be Pascal there. But yeah, maybe there is. Yeah, maybe that's what's... I do think that there is certainly a sense in Fine Gael that Leo Varadkar is in the make or break period of his political career. That the transition from Taoiseach in the last government to Taoiseach in this government wasn't one that he found easy. That you know, Fine Gael was not flourishing in government, and the hope was that when he regained the Taoiseach's office, you know, that would sort of turbocharge Fine Gael's fortunes. I think the jury's pretty much out on that at the moment. But certainly, whatever about letting Leo be Leo, I think that there is certainly an effort underway in the Taoiseach's office to make a concentrated effort to use the position of Taoiseach to advance, you know, not just the country's fortunes, but Fine Gael's political fortunes as well.
Right. We shall leave it there. But as always, we round up with a few articles from the Irish Times over the last week or so. Each of us picks one. I'm going to go first this Friday. I'm going to choose an opinion piece by Finn McRedmond, which excited quite a lot of reaction. I would say 97% of it extremely negative on social media over the last 24 hours or so. She was really responding to the first speech as leader of the Social Democrats in the Dáil by Holly Kearns a week or so ago, where Holly Kearns talked about being a member of the first generation that would be Irish generation that would be worse off than their parents. And that line did really seem to strike a chord with a lot of people. And Finn is arguing against it, really, and pointing out a little bit like if you're familiar with the writings of the author Steven Pinker, the suggestion that we do actually live at a time when it's better to be alive now than it was in any previous generation, that we're more prosperous and we're all the rest of it. Well, I don't know. I don't know what either of you think about this. This is a line that's resonated in other political systems over the last few years, that sense that the project has failed in the United States, in the Rust Belt, in the north of England. And then more recently, there's a kind of generational thing with millennials and Gen Zers saying that baby boomers and Gen Xers are pulling up the ladder behind them. I think it's something we might dig into a little bit more, that idea, over the next while politically, because it does seem quite potent. What do either of you think?
I think that'd be a good idea. I mean, in general, older people always give out that younger people are feckless and irresponsible and are unprepared to make the sort of sacrifices for self-advancement that they themselves did, while younger people always give out about their elders. I do think these things do constitute political undercurrents that are especially important at the moment. And often, I think you have to view that through the prism of the housing crisis, which is not something that we've seen to this extent before, and is something that impacts disproportionately on those younger voters. So I do think there's politics.
And Jack, I mean, I don't know what you think of this. I think that's where Finn's argument falls down, because the data is there that the way our society is structured, where home ownership has traditionally been such an important part of kind of building prosperity over the course of a lifetime. And it seems that the younger generation now are being excluded from that opportunity.
Yeah, look, I think in this, as in many things, it depends on the scope of the question you're asking. I mean, like, yes, if you're going to look at the Steven Pinker view, I forget the name of that book, but I did read it back the day when it was published. Like, if you take the grand expanse of human history, it's true that we're less likely to be killed by marauding invaders now, you know, we're less likely to get dysentery and so on, and that's good. But I suppose the more immediate fear is that there's a generation of young people who are locked out and so on and so forth. But like the political volatility of that, like, Pat was talking about how older people always give out about younger people and younger people always give out about older people. And that's true. And ever has it been, and it may always be the case that is true. But the key question here is, bear with me on this, is whether younger people are becoming older people, not in a chronological sense. I can attest that you do get older as time goes by. But in terms of their quality of life, their assets, the security of their tenure, and I think most vitally, their political outlook, because there is this truism, and it's well grounded in the data, that as you get older, you kind of get more comfortable and get a bit more conservative, and you have more of a stake in the system, and you're less likely to vote against the system. You have an interest in perpetuating the system. And if that stops, if that kind of younger group of now fairly geriatric looking millennials in their mid 30s and even into their early 40s, if they don't start acting like older people, well, then the consequences for the system, for mainstream politics, are pretty severe.
I am confirmed in my view that this is a subject we should devote a whole podcast to at some point, and we will.
Need to find some young people.
Pat, what have you been reading?
Possibly an entire series.
Definitely, yeah. A year of podcasts. God knows how many Europeans would walk past behind you in that time, Pat. Pat, what have you been reading?
Well, I was reading, this morning I was reading Justine McCarthy's In Praise of Johnny Sexton, and which I didn't disagree with a word of, but I'm minded to note Fintan O'Toole's reflections. Well, these are two of our heavyweight political columnists who are both writing about rugby this week, and Fintan O'Toole writing about how he had fallen in love with, despite his class prejudices against rugby, had fallen in love with this Irish rugby team, and he ascribed the credit for this to Andy Farrell, the head coach. I posit another possibility, another explanation as well, is that maybe Fintan O'Toole has actually become middle class, and therefore that's why he's really fallen in love with rugby, rather than because a working class North of England fella is managing them to significant success.
In his defence, Fintan is on the record as conceding the fact that he has been middle class for a terribly long time now. Jack, what have you been reading?
So I picked out a piece by Mark Paul, our London correspondent, who takes us on a whirlwind tour of the annual press and political reception, or rather that's the opening, is the annual press and political reception at the Irish Embassy in Belgravia. And I liked it for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it kind of gets into the personage and outlooks and actions of Martin Fraser, the current Irish ambassador to London. And he's a person I've always kind of found endlessly interesting. When myself and Hugh O'Connell of the Irish Independent were writing our book about COVID, Martin Fraser emerged as this kind of central personality that, you know, does not have a big public profile and, you know, has been in the cockpit steering the state response and advising those who are politically responsible for the state response at some pretty key moments, whether it be the financial crisis, Brexit, and the pandemic. And, you know, he's a kind of personification, I suppose, of the power of, you know, the deep state or the civil service or whatever, and someone who has an instinctive understanding of how to play those power games and how to kind of, you know, advance the interests of the state, I suppose. So I think that it's just it's an interesting little snippet into how he's doing his business over in London. And I suppose more significantly in the medium term, it's looking at who is Steve Baker And the particularly interesting intervention that he made when he kind of did a bit of a mea culpa over how he and how the British government in general had conducted itself across Brexit, and the kind of firestorm that set off behind the scenes in London, and the various bollockings that he got arising from it. And I think it just really got into the personality of, you know, who is someone who is a clearly very interesting man, Steve Baker, may have a bigger political impact here. It already has a big political footprint here, may have a bigger political footprint here in the years to come, and, you know, pulled it all together very nicely and colourfully. So I heartily recommend it.
He's a fascinating sort of character, Steve Baker. I'm always interested to read more about him. We are going to leave it there because Pat is going to have to go off and join the Dutch and the Portuguese and the Hungarians and the Finns for his own lunch. But thanks very much to Pat and to Jack for joining us today. Thanks also to Aideen Finnegan and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We'll be back with you very soon indeed. But until then, thank you very much for listening and have a wonderful weekend. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.